This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
You're back on TSN 1290 online, TSN1290.ca. Coming up in about 5 minutes' time, we'll head out to the Bay Area. Ray Ratto of CSN Bay Area is going to join us, talk about the San Jose Sharks. We spoke about them briefly earlier in the show when we were talking about the playoff races. The San Jose Sharks, a team that perpetually underachieves in the playoffs, is underachieving in the regular season. 10-10-4 so far this season, 24 points in 24 games, fifth in the Pacific Division. A lot of chatter about surrounding Todd McClellan and his job security.
And I think that's unfair. I think Todd McClellan is a good coach. I think he's tried to challenge his team in different ways over the years. If you remember his comments before games 5, 6, and 7 last year, you could see him challenging the team. I don't think the players are there for him to succeed. And I think that falls on that responsibility falls on the shoulders of Doug Wilson. And he's basically tied the team's success to me, to Joe Thornton, who I have great respect for, one of the best passers of all time. But a guy who hasn't played well in big games and in big series, and that's San Jose. That's back to, that's even World Cup and Olympics, and never been that effective when it mattered most against the top guys. And so, and I know that now he's an older player, but I think the locker room and the vibe and how intense they are, I mean, you have to change players at some point. And that doesn't mean changing the peripheral players. That means changing the core. And if you're hesitant to do that, which he has been, then it shouldn't fall on the shoulders. I mean, Doug Wilson has done a nice job building a team that sustains success. But success to me is playoff success. And you've had, Daryl Sutter in there and Ron Wilson in there, and more so Wilson, because, Sutter kind of took that team that was underachieving.
Sure. And
got a lot out of them. But Ron Wilson was there. You bring in Tom McClellan now. You've changed the coaches. You've done different. You have to change the actual fabric of the roster. And then you strip his. And the problem is that they only go halfway. They're like half pregnant here. I'm going to take the captaincy off of Joe Thornton, but I'm going to keep Joe Thornton. I know he has a no trade and all that stuff, but if you really want to trade a guy, you can trade him. So they have not gone all in on anything, and I think it's been mismanaged. And while they've accumulated talent, they haven't done a great job of accumulating a winning team.
They've started to get rid of some of the older players on the San Jose Sharks, starting with Dan Boyle and Brad Stewart and Marty Havlat, Richie. This is a different. The makeup of this team has changed. I agree with you that if you really want to address the nucleus of this team and to me it's a bit of a peculiar situation here, because during the season last year, guys, you signed Marleau and Thornton to 3-year contracts.
That's right.
The San Jose Sharks were one game away from going to the second round, maybe winning the Stanley Cup. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility, considering the team that beat them went on to win the Stanley Cup. So, sorry, 3-0 up on the LA Kings. So, to me, I agree with what Richie's saying, and we'll have Ray Ratto on here momentarily, and I know that he's not in favor of firing Todd McClellan, and I think Todd McClellan is a good coach, and I don't think he's the problem at all. I think the team has, by the way, this team has still got tons of talent, and they're only 4 points behind the Jets for the last playoff spot. So it's not like the season is over here. They've had a lot of road games, so I think we got to wait at least another month or so to get too crazy about their playoff
chances.
But
it's been like 7 years of the same stuff,
right,
and they haven't won.
But I'm talking about just this season, and what are you going to do here? Like, do you blow the whole thing up? And to me, if you were going to blow it up, you would have blown it up in the summer.
That's a problem. Doug Wilson hasn't made... I mean, sure, he made that trade for Thornton years ago. And by the way, they traded... The Thornton trade was Wayne Primeau, Brad Stewart. I mean, they weren't trading big pieces as part of that trade, right?
It was the best trade, probably, in NHL history.
But was it?
Well, I mean, what did Wayne Primeau and Brad Stewart really do for the
Marco
Boston...
Marco Sturm.
What did any of those three guys do for the Boston Bruins?
Maybe it freed up Boston from being tied to Joe Thornton all those years.
Fine. But, I mean, in hindsight, if you look at straight talent for talent...
I realize that. I'm saying, though, I've reevaluated. I agree with you that it was a talent...
You're looking at it in the macro sense as opposed to the micro sense.
Well, look at what happened. Boston didn't get tied to him.
Let's head to break.
They
Ray
won.
Ratto. Comcast Sportsnet Bay Area is going to join us. We'll talk more about the San Jose Sharks and their struggles. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
2 hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, online at tsn1290.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is illegalcurve.com. Drew Mandel alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg trying to get a hold of Ray Ratto from CSN Bay Area to talk about the San Jose Sharks, a team that's in upheaval. Another team that's in upheaval, the Philadelphia Flyers, they're really struggling as Craig Berube is really in the hot seat there in Philadelphia. Ron Hextall has expressed his displeasure with the performance of the Philadelphia Flyers so far this season.
And if I was Craig Berube, I'd express my displeasure with the defense that I've been given and goaltending. I mean, come on, everybody likes to blame the coaches, and there are certain coaches who their time is done and they need to move on. But look at the defense of the Philadelphia Flyers. You're going to tell me they're a playoff team? They're not. Now, the Sharks have the talent to be the playoff team, but there's deeper issues there. It's not as simple. And you look at Edmonton. Well, they don't have the players to me to be a playoff team, but they should be better than they are in this with the record they have now. There's a lot of underachieving squads right now.
Yeah, and the Flyers, Richie, even though they're right now in 13th place in the Eastern Conference, they're only 5 points behind the Panthers for the eighth and final playoff spot there, as we talked about, but very early.
But that's a bad team in a bad conference.
It is. I think there are really only two or three good teams in the Eastern Conference, and I think they're all at the top with Montreal, Pittsburgh, and Tampa Bay there, and you throw the Islanders in there as well. But, you know, you mentioned the defense there and the goaltending, and the goaltending was an issue last year, and you saw it at times. Ray Emery was starting, and Steve Mason eventually took over the position, really just giving them mediocre goaltending last year. But, you know, this defense, it goes back to they aren't fast enough in today's game, Richie. And, you know, you've seen a guy like Michael Delzotto come in and have varying degrees of success. But this used to be the staple of the team. And the Philadelphia Flyers have a lot of talent. You look at Jacob Voracek, and he's leading the league in points, or he's at the top of the league in points. And you have one of the best players who was an MVP candidate last year in Claude Giroux. You have grit there with Wayne Simmonds. And I know R.J. Umberger hasn't quite worked out there, but Sean Couturier is an excellent forward. Matt Reed.
They're all forwards.
You have balance.
They have no defense.
Exactly. And so you have a good team there. And I still think this team can turn around. But, you know, Drew, you mentioned Craig Berube being on the hot seat. He just took over last year. I think it's a question of maybe looking to make a move here as opposed to firing the coach.
Function of a new general manager and not the coach he hired. You hear that's always the case, that sometimes they want to bring in their own guy. But I agree with you guys on that assessment about the Philadelphia Flyers.
You fired Peter Laviolette 3 games into the season, and Craig Berube turned the season around, sure. And now all of a sudden you're going to blame Craig Berube for the struggles?
Can you turn a season around for 3 games?
Well, whatever the case, he got them into the playoffs last year.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from CSNBayArea.com, Ray Ratto. Ray, good afternoon, and thanks for joining us.
How are you?
Doing very well. How about yourself?
Watching Sunderland and Chelsea, and I'm bored out of my tree.
Well, I'd like to pretend I know what's happening in that game, but I don't have any clue whatsoever. So we brought you on to talk about hockey instead. How about that?
That sounds good to me.
It seems like the San Jose Sharks would be of a little more interest. You wrote an article on CSNBayArea.com earlier this week. It's tweeted out via our Twitter feed right now, saying that if the San Jose Sharks were to fire Todd McLellan, it would be a monumental error by the team. Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I think, one, firing the coach in hockey is almost a fetish. It's, gee, we're out of ideas, let's do this. When, in fact, it's pretty clear that McLellan is one of the best coaches in the league, highly regarded almost by every other franchise there is. And when you're going bad, and they are going bad, you just don't give up an asset for no good reason. I think he's really bright. The staff he has is really bright. I think the players have had a hard time figuring out, you know, what kind of team they're supposed to be. And they're not very deep. Again, I think that's probably been of the problems that San Jose has had over the last decade. That's been the one thing that's been their undoing. They haven't been deep enough. And I think teams know that, and they play accordingly. They they don't mind letting San Jose's third and fourth lines try to beat them because they're not going to. And I think it's, you know, that takes more creativity. It takes a deeper farm system. It takes creative trades at the fringes, and they're not getting any of those right now.
Ray, when you look at the locker room, and maybe this is Doug Wilson and Joe Thornton here, you sign Joe Thornton to an extension, Marlowe as well. You give him a no move for three more years at 6.75. And then within a matter of months, you're deciding that he's not the leader, and certainly not a leader, and you're going to take the captaincy off. Does that show that there's maybe a lack of vision for this organization?
I don't know if it does or not, because I think one of the things that was starting to happen last year was that the younger impact players, Pavelski, Couture, Vlasic, I think they needed to figure out how to come into their own. And, you know, Thornton is a big presence in the room. I mean, we're not talking about his play. His play is, you know, as you see it, he's pretty important to them. But I think in the room, they needed other players to grow. And I think some of them felt like the opportunities to do that weren't there as long as Thornton was sort of the fulcrum of the locker room. And so when they took the C away from him, it may have bothered him some. He may have felt it was scapegoating. But there was a reason for doing it that made sense. I don't know that they explained it as well as they could have. But I think the general idea was good, which was get more people involved in the sort of the day-to-day organics of the team itself. Because if you're not going to break that team up and you don't want to be, you know, one player centric in the room, you've got to expand responsibilities. And that's one of the ways you do that.
Ray, the trade that was made last week, the San Jose Sharks acquiring Brendan Dillon for Jason Demers and that third-round draft pick, of course, Jason Demers going to the Dallas Stars. Why do you think that trade was made, and do you think that's going to help the Sharks' fortunes?
I think the trade was made because they wanted to get some new faces in the room. I think Demers had sort of run his course there. Dillon, I think, is a more promising player, the danger being that, you know, he could be gone sooner, and he's going to be more expensive ultimately in the role. In the long run, but I think they just wanted to, you know, shake the cage a bit, because San Jose has this habit, and they've had it over the years, of getting a little comfortable and a little staid, and every once in a while, they sort of need a jump start, and this was sort of their version of that this time. Does it dramatically change their fortunes? I wouldn't say long term that it does. But the one thing we do know about them is that San Jose makes players feel comfortable, and I think the best hockey teams have a little bit of discomfort in them.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is Ray Ratto of CSNBayArea.com talking about the San Jose Sharks.
I agree with you, Ray, in terms of that discomfort. And I'm fascinated about this because you were talking before about Joe Thornton. We asked you about him. And maybe that lack of comfort by taking away kind of that leadership role from him. But has management, and maybe not the coaching staff, but maybe you could speak more to that, has management, maybe the coaching staff, kind of created a players against coaches and management because of that decision? Because the players are almost always going to back up their teammate. And if they feel like he's embarrassed, maybe they feel like they're playing, you know, in spite of ownership of the management and coaching and not for it.
It's hard to get a read on these guys in a lot of ways, because on the one hand, I think they, you know, the younger guys did want more of a presence in the room. On the other hand, they probably would have wanted to figure out a less obtrusive way to do it. Mm-hmm. But I think when they lost that series to Los Angeles, there was a real impulse to blow stuff up. Because, you know, that's the kind of loss that can really damage a franchise for more than 1 year. And I think, you know, the argument about who wears the C was not a terribly big one, but I suspect it's probably one that could have waited a while and just to let things settle down, because, I mean, the series itself was traumatic enough. and then to have, you know, sort of the immediate, we need to lash out at something. Because they were not in a position to make massive trades. I mean, they're, you know, Thornton and Marlowe, who, you know, one, had no trade deals, and two, have been pretty good players. Mm-hmm. I mean, Marlowe has improved dramatically over the last couple of years. He's more of a two-way player than he's ever been. I just think they needed to figure out what the culture was, what they need to do to fix it, and this was sort of their first stab at it. It wasn't substantive, and I think it just created an irritation that sort of flies in the face of that sort of sense of comfort that they all have, because they live in a place where the weather's always nice. They're relatively well off. They live in a fairly affluent area of the Bay Area. I mean, life's pretty good. And I think with hockey teams, to a certain extent, you're asking a lot of them, and you're asking a lot of them day in and day out. So they need to be sort of a little bit annoyed. And I think maybe they're not used to annoyance as much as they should be. That's just pop psychology, I grant you. But, you know, things have been pretty, you know, pretty staid for them. Not a lot have asked of them by the market or by the fan base. And maybe that's part of the problem, too, is that you can get by in San Jose more than you can in a lot of other places. And I think getting by has gotten old.
You mentioned Todd McClellan, and I agree with you. I think that would be a mistake to fire Todd McClellan. And his job security seems like it's waning a bit. Doug Wilson, is he on solid ground regardless?
As near as we can tell, he is. One of the interesting dynamics about San Jose is that their owner, a guy named Hasso Plattner, is a German national, German business, a German billionaire, you know, which is a nice gig to have. And he can't be in the country, I think, more than a set number of days in a row. So he is in some ways an absentee owner. So really the hockey direction comes from Wilson, and he's usually been pretty collaborative about stuff like this, but I think this is sort of their first real fear that the window is closing in a long mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a little bit of a free fall shock. You know, what do we do about this? Because it's not a team that, you know, it impresses you with its vibrancy. I mean, all their you know, secondary metrics are down. They're not as good in the faceoff circle as they used to be. They're not as good with puck possession as they typically were. And Todd McClellan came in as a puck possession guy. And it's not like he stopped teaching that. It's just that this team is not as good at it. And I think it gets back to just how it's sort of top-heavy structured. The first two lines are very good. Second two lines don't contribute a whole lot. And they're not as deep on defense as they ought to be. And I think those combinations, more than anything else, make it tough for them to put whole games together. And the best teams put whole games together.
Ray, if they were to make a move and maybe dismiss Todd McClellan or do something else, is the culture in that organization going to change if only one move is made? Or is it going to take multiple moves? Maybe the coach and some players, or some player, you know, more than one player leaving. Is it just a one-move fix at this point?
I don't know, because it would depend on the move. I don't think Hasso Plattner is in a frame of mind to fire Wilson. I'm not sure whether Wilson is in a frame of mind to replace McClellan. It's hard to tell whether McClellan is still happy, just because I think his frustrations about the way the team are playing are sort of more to the surface than they used to be. I'm not sure that there is one move that gets the culture changed, or whether the culture needs to be changed or just tweaked. I mean, I don't know how you manufacture discomfort. And that's one of the reasons why I think the Sharks are a hard team to figure, why people fall in love with their talent and then wonder in April why they don't have enough heart. I think they may have less talent and more heart than they're given credit for, but they don't have enough talent to make that matter. I just don't. I mean, in a lot of ways, I think we're overthinking the Sharks. I think it's just the roster's not deep enough. They don't have enough good players on the third and fourth lines. They're not very cohesive there, and they have not gotten great goaltending the last couple of years either. They used mm-hmm. to be a sort of a goaltending farm for a lot of teams, and now other franchises have taken that over. You know, Anaheim comes immediately to mind. So I think one of their problems is that they don't have enough depth of talent. And maybe that's where you create the discomfort, where you can sit a guy, put another guy in, and not lose anything. Maybe that's where the problem lies. It's, you know, people have tried to figure this out 12 different ways, and depending on who you ask, you'll get 12 different answers. But maybe when you boil this down and you get past the culture of the locker room and, you know, who's in charge of what, maybe it's just that there's not enough fear of your position, that the team doesn't have enough good players in the pipeline to make the players who are already on the big club sweat enough.
Ray, we've got one last question for you here. You know, you talk about the talent on the San Jose Sharks roster, and obviously one of the most talented guys on the roster is Brent Burns, and we talk about him. He's one of the favorites of this show, but that move going back from forward to defense, that's a key move, and one of the main reasons is because Dan Boyle's not there, and he's got the point totals. He's got 19 points in 24 games, but you watch the Sharks a lot. How have you seen his transition back to defense from forward?
Well, I always thought he was a better wing because you know, he had, you know, he's inclined that way anyway. I think he's sort of in his head, he's an offensive player. And the Sharks really don't have more than one really good stay-at-home defenseman, and that's Vlasic. So I think in some ways, moving Burns is an acknowledgement that they don't have enough good defensemen. And, you know, it's a gamble that they have enough forwards to make up for what they would lose from Burns. I think it's a defensive move in that they're trying to cover up a deficiency rather than finding a new way to use him better. But, you know, the exigencies of the roster, you know, sort of demand that he be there because they don't have enough other guys. I mean, they tried to get through last year with Scott Hannon and Brad Stewart, both of whom are about 112 years old. And, you know, you don't get to have, you know, two defensemen of that age and get away with it unless they're Nicholas Lidstrom types, and neither of those guys are that.
Ray Ratto is a columnist for CSNBayArea.com. He joins us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show to discuss the San Jose Sharks. Ray, appreciate the time, and we'll let you get back to the boring soccer game.
Well, you know, I'm just waiting for the Grey Cup, like everybody else.
ESPN2, I think, tomorrow, right?
Wouldn't miss it.
There you go. Thanks, Ray. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Take care. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
25 minutes before 1 o'clock. Actually, 25 minutes after 12 o'clock. 35 minutes before 1 o'clock. Simple math is my strong suit. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Immediately following us, right across all TSN radio stations here in this fine country, Grey Cup Saturday gets you set for the big game tomorrow night. Of course, a game you can see on TSN here on TSN 1290. The Stampeders and the Tiger Cats in the Grey Cup live from BC. Ken Campbell of the Hockey News is going to join us in about 5 minutes' time to talk about Pat Quinn. Pat Quinn obviously passed away earlier this week. Longtime NHL head coach, longtime general manager. Richard, do you remember him most? Is your greatest memory of him the 2002 Olympics?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the height of his success, Drew. I think if you grew up in Winnipeg, kind of, you know, around our age, you remember Pat Quinn being the coach of the Canucks, chewing gum, and kind of that big presence behind the Vancouver Canucks bench, playing the Jets in the playoffs. That's my kind of, when I think of Pat Quinn, that's what I think of first. And I do think of him as a winner, even though he didn't win a Stanley Cup and he came so close. He won, you know, under 18, he won World Juniors, he won the World Cup, and he won the Olympics. I mean, he's a winner. And
two-time Jack Adams Award winner as NHL's Coach of the Year.
That too, and he was old school in that he told it how it was, He gave you respect, and you gave him respect. He was a straight shooter. He didn't speak in cliches. He was bright. And the game needs more guys like him. And I thought Brian Burke had some really great comments about Pat Quinn. I thought that was, I think it was Eric Francis' article in the Calgary Sun.
It was.
Talking about, we should tweet it out, talking about Brian Burke, talking about the effect that Pat Quinn had on his life. Both Irish looking up to him and Quinn being older, and Quinn actually having him in training camp when he was coaching the Philadelphia Flyers. And it's a really interesting article. And they just don't make him like Pat Quinn anymore. You listen to coaches these days, and it's cliche speak, and it's a lot of them aren't as upfront with the players. Still a lot of them are, but a lot of them aren't as upfront with the players as a guy like Pat Quinn was. And I thought it was interesting. I don't know who told this story. I was talking about, you know, benching guys, and it's easy for certainly us on this show, for managers even, to say to the coach, you know, I think this guy should be benched. He's like, well, okay. It was about Ty Domi. I say, okay. But just remember that Ty Domi is going to be the guy who gets off the bus with us, gets on the bus with us, walks by you in the hallway, walks by his teammates. And you're talking about a person. You're not talking about a thing. You're talking about somebody with emotions. He thought about people from their, you know, the players from their perspective. And he was considerate. And he was, you know, both empathetic and sympathetic. I thought he, again, and he coached a way where he would open up the game. He would allow skill to flourish, not overcoach the game. If everybody coached like Pat Quinn, these games would be so exciting to watch. Now we're watching dull hockey, 2-1. Hopefully somebody turns the puck over in the neutral zone and there's a 2-on-1 chance. Otherwise, you don't see much at all. If you watch Pat Quinn teams, you go back and watch the Leafs games, you go back and watch the Vancouver games, open it up. Even the Edmonton, the one year that Steve Tambellini was somehow in charge. they, you know, I don't even think it's... Steve Tambellini mishandled the Pat Quinn thing because he didn't give him more time, but maybe people said he didn't coach Ezzie to... he didn't coach the way the game was being coached now and the systems and all that stuff. But, you know, maybe he was stubborn. I think sometimes stubbornness can be a good quality.
Yeah, Pat Quinn is a very tough loss, and you mentioned how he treated people, and really you see, and we already knew the character of Pat Quinn. He's a legend in hockey, and Drew, you mentioned some of his accomplishments right off the top of the segment, but all of the nice things that were said about Pat Quinn, whether you read it in articles by Ken Campbell or Cam Cole, Eric Francis, or tweets, or some of the insiders that you would see on TSN, the guy left an indelible mark mm-hmm. on hockey mm-hmm. and at every single level, in Vancouver, in Toronto, at the Olympics for the World Juniors. And it's very sad because he's a legend. And, you know, you have to think that there's a spot in the Hockey Hall of Fame that's just waiting for him.
I agree with you 100%. That Pat Quinn is a Hall of Famer, no doubt. It's going to be unfortunate because I hope and I think he will get in. It'll be unfortunate that both him and Pat Burns won't be able to receive it. You know, their family will be there to receive it on their behalf. But certainly be looking down. And we could do a whole three-hour show, I think, on Pat Quinn's career. I think that would probably be not giving him enough credit.
Well, you mentioned, you know, his coaching style. How many playoff rounds have the Toronto Maple Leafs won since 2006?
John Ferguson Jr. fired him, actually hired Paul Maurice, but you're exactly right.
That's obviously not a knock to Paul Maurice, but I'm saying is, like, they haven't been as successful. You're right. Period from 1998 to 2006, which Ken Campbell was there covering the team mm-hmm. for the Star. I mean, those were some of the best years that they'd had since, I mean, well, you could even go back to the years they won the Stanley Cup in 1967. I mean, that team was a mess when he took over.
It was, and he brought a bunch of veterans together. He knew he had a good goaltender and could play the open style. They played a tough game. You know, should they have beat Carolina and Buffalo? Sure. But Carolina, that was a close one there in Game 6, In Buffalo, they certainly had, against Buffalo, the other chances in 99. So, you know, a great career and a really unfortunate loss.
Let's head to break. When we come back, Ken Campbell of the Hockey News is going to join us to talk about his experiences with Pat Quinn. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel alongside Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, Let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from the Hockey News, Ken Campbell. Ken, good afternoon, and thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Ken, we brought you on, of course, to talk about Pat Quinn. He passed away earlier this week. The hockey world's been mourning his loss. You know him from your days with the Toronto Star when you were the beat writer for the Star back, and you started, I believe, back in February of 1999, give or take a few months. You know, what are your main reminiscences of Pat Quinn, and you know, what stands out to you the most about your time dealing with him?
Well, I think just, you know, with Pat, he was... He was an interesting guy, probably one of the most interesting guys I've ever covered. He openly had a disdain for people of my ilk. But on the same hand, I've never spoken to a coach ever, not at any level of hockey in all the years I've been involved in hockey, who was more engaging and more insightful than Pat Quinn. I mean, that guy, you know, when he got talking about hockey and he got going in a scrum, we'd all walk away and go, wow, that was amazing. And, I mean, I learned a ton about the game from this guy. Like, I didn't just take from him and take his quotes, but I learned a lot about the game. And he was such an interesting guy. Like, I mean, as a player, you know, he was this big, lumbering defenseman who was a stay-at-home guy and you know, a real physical guy. And he coached exactly oppositely. He was, you know, big on moving the puck quickly, moving your feet quickly, creating offense, you know, getting in on the forecheck, a lot of speed, you know. So he was here when, you know, it was an exciting, pretty exciting team to cover. They were fun to watch. They were fun to follow, and they had a fair bit of success here too. I mean, by Toronto standards, of course. But you know, two conference finals in the 8 years that he was here, and they made the playoffs every year, but the last year. So I thought he did a great job here, and he was, you know, like I said, one of the more interesting guys I've ever covered.
He had a blog post about it, talking about Pat Quinn, you know, his relationship with yourself and the media in general, and saying that he might have had disdain, as you mentioned in your previous answer, he also showed the media respect. And can you speak to that, especially considering the pressure that goes along with coaching the Leafs and how much media attention there is?
Yeah, I mean, quite honestly, guys, I think that gets that whole media attention thing in Toronto gets a little overblown. And I think that, you know, my personal feeling about Toronto is that the team allows its players and its management to use that as a crutch and to use that as an excuse for failure. And I don't think it's right. I mean, you know, there's no more pressure in Toronto than there is to play football for the Dallas Cowboys or soccer for Manchester United or, you know, basketball for the Los Angeles Lakers. So, I mean, yeah, there is a lot of pressure. There's a lot of scrutiny. But I think that's a bit, that's a bit overblown. But that being said, you know, I mean, this guy, like I said, he didn't particularly, or he would profess to not liking dealing with us because he always dealt with us very well, but he always respected you. And when you asked a good question and you sounded like you knew what you were talking about, he had all the time in the world for you. So, you know, he was really good that way. And as much as he, you know, as much as he held a disdain, he never let that, you know, affect his ability to treat everybody with, you know, common decency and respect, which is what he did pretty well with everyone his whole life, as you've been hearing over the past couple of days since he's died. You know, a lot of people, you know, coming out with stories about what a great guy he was and how wonderful he was to them, and it's not a real surprise.
Ken, you know, Pat Quinn is remembered a lot as the coach of the Vancouver Canucks and the Toronto Maple Leafs, but one record that might never be broken is when he was with the Philadelphia Flyers as the head coach in 79-80, the 35-game unbeaten streak.
Yeah.
What do you remember most about that incredible streak, and what did that really do for, as far as showing how good of a coach he was going forward?
Well, and that was his first coaching job, and I believe that was his rookie year of his first coaching job, if I'm not mistaken. I might be mistaken on that, but he was a young coach, and I think it just showed that he was the kind of coach that, you know, he was always a coach that coached to win instead of coaching not to lose. And a lot of guys coach not to lose. And you can see it in the way their teams play. They play very cautious. They play very, you know, careful. They wait for the other team to make a mistake. You know, that all those things. Like, Pat Quinn was not a real X's and O's guy. He wasn't a guy who ran, like, really great practices. I remember we'd watch practice and we'd go, wow, this is kind of a low-tempo practice. But he always had a really good feel for his team and what it could do and what it could take, and, you know, that it had veteran players on it who would show up and play. But, you know, I think the fact that he had that streak showed that he was a coach that coached to win, not to not lose. And he was the kind of guy who would let his players play. He had an excellent feel for who was going that night and who wasn't. And he was always, and I think what players most appreciated about him was, you know, if you lost a key faceoff or your man got loose and he scored, or, you know, you made a really bad play, an error of commission, you know, he'd put you right back out there and you'd get a chance to redeem yourself. And I think that's what, you know, that's what most athletes want when something like that happens. So, that just goes to show what kind of a coach he was and how much he wanted to win and how much he wanted to win the right way.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. Our guest is Ken Campbell of the Hockey News, discussing Pat Quinn and his legacy in the game of hockey. Ken, to your mind, do you think Pat Quinn was a better coach, general manager, or player?
Oh, coach, by a long shot, by miles and miles and miles and miles. can I get any more distance between it? No, I think he was a below average player. He was a guy who basically only played in the league because of expansion. If the league hadn't expanded to 12 teams, we probably would have never heard of Pat Quinn, at least as a player. He ended up playing 600 games because the league expanded in 1967 and then got, you know, progressively bigger in the next couple of years, and ended up playing most of his games, I believe, with the Atlanta Flames, and he was the captain of that team before he retired. So he was a decent player. He wasn't a great player. He was a slower guy who was real physical, who would make you pay the price going down the wing, he was really physical, but he never made his mark as a player. As a GM, he was, again, I would say, just okay. I thought there were some moves that he made in Toronto that were real head scratchers. And in fact, when he was in Toronto, there were times when I was amazed at how little he knew about even the players he was acquiring sometimes. You know, we'd sort of shake our heads and go, wow, I can't believe you didn't know that about that guy. And in Vancouver, he did do some good things. I mean, obviously getting Pavel Bure and building that team that went to the Stanley Cup final was quite a feat, but I would say his strength was in coaching. And that's what he liked doing. I mean, he only took the GM job in Toronto for that short time out of self-preservation, because Ken Dryden and Mike Smith were, you know, at each other's throats, and he figured they were going to bring in someone he wouldn't be able to work with. So when they offered him the job, he basically said, yeah, I guess I'll take it out of self-preservation. I don't think he ever wanted to do it. I think he enjoyed coaching the most, and I definitely think that's what he was best at.
Ken, when you look at Pat Quinn, you know, he didn't win the Stanley Cup, and we'll ask you about that in a second here, but of course he was successful internationally, and I think the pinnacle of that would have been the 2002 Salt Lake City Olympics. Can you talk about his role on that team and how maybe the X's and O's, or the lack of X's and O's, and more so knowing the players, helped him and lead that team to gold medal?
Well, I think the biggest thing you can say about Pat Quinn with that team is he risked alienating his relationship mm-hmm. With his own star goaltender in Toronto in order to win a gold medal. If you recall, they were beaten, I think, 5-2 by Sweden in the first game. They didn't look very good, and Curtis didn't look very good. Curtis Joseph didn't look very good. And, you know, he had a big decision to make. And, you know, there are guys who pick, when they pick these teams, they sometimes pick their own players. You know, that's why I admire a guy like Steve Yzerman, who went with his gut and actually went with his coaching staff and went with the consensus and didn't pick Marty St. Louis for that Olympic team until Stamkos got hurt and then he was a replacement. But I mean, Pat, you know, could have gone right back with Curtis and said, you know, he's my guy, I've got faith in him, blah, blah, blah. No, he didn't. He went with Martin Brodeur, and it turned out to be the right thing. And, you know, I know Curtis wasn't very happy about it. I remember the first game back, they were doing some sort of ceremony to honor them, and Pat went out to center ice, mm-hmm. and then Curtis skated out, and rather than shake hands with Pat, he just stuck out his blocker and sort of hit Pat's hand with his blocker, and we were all going, I wonder how this is going to play out. It ended up playing out just fine. I don't think Curtis really held it against Pat, but I mean, just to do something like that, I think that's a perfect example of, you know, knowing your guys and knowing what's going to win, and and doing what's best for the team, regardless of what might be best for you personally.
Ken, you mentioned Pat Quinn's time earlier as president, GM, and coach of the Vancouver Canucks, and everyone remembers, as long as you're old enough to remember, 1994 and the Vancouver Canucks coming really close to beating the New York Rangers for the Stanley Cup. Do you think this was Pat Quinn's greatest accomplishment, considering that he was the architect and the man behind the bench for that team?
Yeah, I would agree with that in terms of NHL accomplishments, for sure. I mean, he had good years in Toronto, but his best years were in Vancouver, for sure. And I think that's where his heart always was. That's where he went back in the summers, and that's where he lived and ultimately died as well. So that was his home, and I think that's the work that he was most proud of. And just the fact that he brought that team along, like he said, as a GM, and then, being the guy behind the bench, pulling the levers, and, bringing that team back from down, down 3-1 in the final to the New York Rangers. To within one goal of, tying the thing up and sending it to overtime in Game 7. I definitely think that would have been probably his greatest accomplishment, for sure, in the NHL.
Ken, we'll let you go on this last question. In your blog, you mentioned that you believe Pat Quinn will eventually go into the Hockey Hall of Fame. How quickly do you see that happening, if at all?
I'm not sure. It's hard to say. I mean, they couldn't put him in before because he was chairman of the selection committee, and they already did that with Jim Gregory. And they caught a lot of flack for it, and rightly so. You can't induct the guy who decides who gets in. You can't induct him while he's the chairman of the selection committee. So, I would suspect his name will come up next year. I've got to think that there's a very good chance that it'll happen next year, if not, in the coming years. I mean, Pat Burns, it took a while for him to get in, but I would suspect he'll be in sooner rather than later, and I'm not saying it will happen, but I wouldn't be surprised if he's in the class of 2015 as a builder.
Ken Campbell covers the NHL for the Hockey News, formerly covered the Toronto Maple Leafs. He joins us to talk about Pat Quinn. Ken, appreciate the time. Thanks very much for doing this.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Take care, and thanks very much.
Take care.
Yep. Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Tim. Rusty, Tim.
Rusty.
Richard's not going to stand for that. No Bruce Springsteen to end the show? Oh, boy. That's troubles, Tim. That's real troubles. Welcome back to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thank you to Ken Campbell for joining us to talk about Pat Quinn. In case you missed any of it, it's available for download on iTunes, on tsn1290.ca, and on thelegalcurve.com. This final segment today is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, the longest-running independent comedy club in North America. For over 25 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. It's all 30 years. They had their anniversary earlier this month. To purchase tickets for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Gentlemen, a trade in the NHL sort of later in the day yesterday. The Anaheim Ducks acquired defenseman Eric Brewer from the Tampa Bay Lightning in exchange for a third-round pick in the 2015 NHL draft. As part of the trade, the Lightning retain about just over $1 million in salary from Eric Brewer. He's going to be an unrestricted free agent at the end of the season, making $3.875 million in a cap hit. Your thoughts on the Tampa Bay Lightning shipping out Eric Brewer and the Ducks acquiring him?
I mean, I don't have an issue with Tampa Bay trading Eric Brewer here. I mean, Eric Brewer is a guy who moves not the greatest on the not can be great on on the power play. Really, he can make a nice first pass, Drew, and he's a big guy. He's got a long reach. He used to be a far better skater than he is now. The years and the injuries and such have taken a toll on him. So Eric Brewer doesn't move as well. He used to move very well for a big guy. Doesn't so much anymore. And Tampa Bay, wants to play a fast game. I don't think he necessarily fits into that. Anaheim's a little bit more, wants to add size. I mean, Brewer can be physical, but he's not an overly physical player. I think if you look at it a little bit from a different perspective, in the sense that you trade Brian Allen for the Rene Bork contract, and is that kind of a contract flip, but then you bring in Eric Brewer. Eric Brewer and Brian Allen, big guys, left-handed shooting guys. The difference between them is Brewer still moves better than Brian Allen, but Brewer's a better puck mover. Brewer gets the puck out of his own zone better than Brian Allen does. So clearly Anaheim is looking for depth and puck-moving depth. They feel like with the forecheck pressure of the other teams in their division, it's going to be difficult to get out of the conference unless they're able to get the puck out of their own zone to a lot of their talented forwards. So that's how I see the trade.
I think you nailed it there, Richie. I think Eric Brewer replaces Brian Allen, really. And, you know, you give up the third-round pick, and Tampa Bay gets rid of some of that salary. But it's a trade that makes sense to me. I like this move for Anaheim, and I guess I like it for the Tampa Bay Lightning in the sense that you see who they've brought in over the last couple of years. Mark Barberio, Andre Schuster, they really like on the back end there. And Victor Hedman actually might play tonight. He's been out the last 4 or 5 weeks.
Yes, thank God he's on my fantasy team.
Yeah, Drew, yeah, no one cares.
That's what I was talking about. And also the Anaheim Ducks. You look at the Anaheim Ducks, and Francois Beauchemin had that illness, and Clayton Stoner, who they brought over from the Minnesota Wild, he's had injury problems. You've got Josh Manson, son of Dave Manson, playing, and he's done a nice job there, but you've got a young defense there with Hampus Lindholm, Richie, Sammy Vatanen.
So both good players. Both good players.
Both very good players, but you know, you look at going towards playoff time, the Anaheim Ducks are a top team in the Western Conference. You bring in Eric Brewer, who, as you mentioned, he doesn't skate like he used to, speaking of former Canadian Olympians, Eric Brewer. So it's a good move for them. They bring in a veteran, and you know, we talked to Ray Rotto about this. You know, you want to have those veterans on the third pairing there, and I think he isn't going to hurt you. Maybe like a guy like Scott Hannon was hurting the San Jose Sharks last year, unfortunately. But it's a good move for them. He's still got some gas in the tank. He's not going to play 20 minutes a game. He'll play 15 minutes a game, something like that. But a good move for the Ducks, because even though the Ducks are going along quite nicely here, their defense maybe isn't at that same level, for example, as an LA's was the years they've won the Stanley Cups. They're still kind of tweaking that D on Anaheim. And I know, Richie, you mentioned that Lindholm and Vatanen, good puck movers, smaller skilled guys.
Well, Lindholm's big. It's just Vatanen's not as big, but he moves the
smaller
puck.
Smaller in the weight sense.
Yeah, both move the puck really well.
One other move from around the NHL. We got about a minute or so here. The Oilers fired their goaltender coach earlier this week. Pretty much I just included this so we can make fun of the Oilers for the next
minute. Yeah, and let's make fun of the Oilers, because that's a classic Edmonton Oilers thing. Blame the guy at the bottom of the totem pole. Well, what? Because, oh, you know what we'll do? We'll bring in two goalies who aren't very good, and then we're going to blame the goaltending coach because they're not very good.
Mm-hmm.
And fire coaches and not address the fact that every player they put together is the same and their defense is dreadful.
Justin Schultz was a healthy scratch against Nashville on Thursday night.
Well, they lost to Nashville in overtime. That shift was, if you watch that shift in overtime when they allowed the goal, I mean, there was like 10 chances on one shift. They lose yesterday. This is exactly what organizations like that do. They blame everybody who doesn't need to be blamed. The people at the top are the ones who get off scot-free.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And cheers.
No, not good enough. He's a bad boy.
I never seen something stinks like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Richard Pollock.
My God, cheer. It's been a tough week in the hockey world. We've lost a lot of good people. You know, you talked about Victor Tikhonov and other people that we weren't overly aware of, but you hear their names. Pat Quinn, at the end of the day, I mean, going back to what we were talking about before, he gets a cheer for treating people like human beings and treating them as they should be treated. And I think that gets a cheer. More than anything of his hockey accomplishments, I think it was the way he treated people that should get the most recognition and acknowledgement for.
I like that cheer. You obviously know who I'm cheering. Marty Brodeur.
That's fair. It's topical now.
Doug Armstrong has brought him in, you know, to practice with the team. And, hey, you never know. You might see Marty Brodeur playing for the St. Louis Blues. So good for Marty for sticking in there.
We will see if that's happening. Richard, I'll echo your cheer about Pat Quinn and all the great men in the hockey world that we lost this week. That's it for this Saturday in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thank you to Dennis Bayak joining us for Saturday Spotlight. In case you missed any of that interview, you can find it on our website, on iTunes, and on tsn1290.ca. Also, big thanks to our guest Ray Ratto of csnbayarea.com and to Ken Campbell of the Hockey News. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, and Bernstein's Deli. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and the website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. For my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Big thanks to producer Tim behind the board, getting us on and off like the expert that he is. Until next Saturday, you do know that if it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Stay tuned for Grey Cup Saturday on TSN 1290.
You've been listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.